text as either the model for what is translated or as the paradigmatic medium for it. In wanting to avoid a textual model, I'm concerned that it obscures the extent to which the bulk of translation is not carried on between different characters and typeface, but between persons in rooms, streets, lecture halls and telephone conversations. Translation must relate, in other words, not only the things people say to one another, but also to how and where they say them. In conceptual terms, at least, I want to suggest, thinking of translation as a real-world activity, which exceeds its immediate objects and is diffused among the spaces and practices that occurs with it, draws it into proximity with the developing discourse on affect, ambience, and atmosphere, which the philosopher Gernot Boehme has characterised as a return to aesthetics. Although Boehme retains the arts as his model, his aesthetics of atmosphere presents them in continuity with the real world, in inverted commas, beyond the theatre or concert hall or art gallery, rather than as states of exception. Stripped back to its Greek origins and shorn of high cultural baggage, Boehme presents aesthesis as a matter of making sense, of drawing oneself into or together with one's situation in search of some kind of sensible order. This is not a matter of abstraction and reflection, but of attending to, in the sense of looking, listening, palpating, shifting, and so on, the dynamic qualities of one's situation. As Ben Anderson has noted, there is a degree of correspondence between Boehme's perspective and the animate contours and energies of the so-called vitality affects with which the psychologist Daniel Stern has tried to characterise the extra-linguistic and intersubjective properties of mother and child communication and, latterly, of dance. In this paper, I want to take up some of the various strands of this proposition, that translation might be approached as an atmospheric concern, in which the everyday and the aesthetic are contiguous. In doing so, I hope to approach translation less as a means of understanding the difference of thought or imagination of the other, than of the immediacy, albeit momentary, of shared experience. I do not approach this as either a translator nor as a language expert. Indeed, as the philosopher and sinologist François Julien has suggested, translation serves to draw attention to the explanatory presumptions of one's own language, at least as much as it seeks to bring those of others within its ambit. It needs help, in other words, in making sense. And that sense, I will suggest, is not always in the words that we speak or hear, even as speaking and listening may remain the best or most convenient way of describing it in aesthetic or affective terms. Translation of this sort, I suggest, does not simply replace one mode of expression with a comparable other, as in the way of simultaneous interpretation, but is worked out at those points where context, language, practice, and the feelings which run with them encounter differences or gaps in understanding, upon which, Julien argues, dialogue is predicated and must move across. We are, Julien suggests, obliged to seek the common within or across this gap, rather than the resemblances of one side to the other. It is a translation in which meaning is uncovered in the process of transitions between one language and another, rather than in correspondence from one to another, such as between Chinese and European language contexts. However, whilst I find much of interest in Julien's theory of translation, it is to my mind something of a one-sided account. Julien's concerns lie heavily with language, with the production and reception of meaning. But in delving into differing orders and depths of feelings revealed across semantic gaps, one runs the risk of ignoring those feelings, particular or peculiar to the production and reception of language itself, even before it arises or is interpreted as meaningful. In encounters across cultures, we must make efforts to listen as much as speak to one another, and draw our habits of comportment into the kinesthetic range of those of others, as per Stern's vitality affects. So, to what's taking place here. It's November 2012 in Beijing. The weather is cold and clear, and the deadly smog which will soon envelop the Chinese capital has yet to descend. In a bright and airy studio on the seventh floor of the Beijing Dance Academy's new building, a small boy and a lithe young man move and gesture together. From the sides of the room, seated on the floor and surrounded by cast-off winter coats, a small group of adults watch as discreetly as they are able. Periodically, a young woman stops the two, man and boy, and warmly and kindly gives them instructions to repeat what they have been doing differently. She looks the boy in the face and gestures to him. He looks intently at her, then back at his partner, and they begin again. Ma Xiaolong, the man, and Fan Ji, the boy, are rehearsing for Say to Him, one of 12 new pieces of contemporary dance performance which will form the programme for the Light and Water Festival. The festival and the creative processes which inform it are the latest instalment of the Arts Cross project. In each iteration of the project, choreographers and dancers are invited to create 10-minute experimental pieces, but to also do so with the cosmopolitan possibilities, within the cosmopolitan possibilities offered by working across national, cultural, and linguistic differences. Similarly, the observing scholars, many of whom are or have been practicing artists, are encouraged to extend their interests in affects, modernity, or whatever, within the wider context of an effort to explain these ideas outside of one's immediate cultural, critical, and linguistic range of reference. Or at least that's the proposition. In reality, a good deal of realpolitik has emerged in which scholarly and artistic good intentions have had to compete with the fallout from 60 years of tension across the Taiwan Strait, the post-colonial fallout encountered by Western artists and academics heading east, and the needs of large cultural institutions, such as the Beijing Dance Academy, to project their identity to national and international audiences, alongside any needs to relax convention in the spirit of collaboration. This is not to say that the project has failed to generate experimental practice and dialogue, but rather to add a caveat to what I'm about to discuss. Although this largely pertains to thoughts stemming from a very particular moment in this project, these thoughts cannot be run entirely separately from the wider institutional, cultural, and political context which it draws together. Who gets to watch whom, where, and under what sorts of provisions are clearly questions imbued with the vectors of various sorts of power and its projection. These are, of course, as present in rehearsal rooms as they are in any other sort of social space, and may inform the atmosphere experienced by those working within them over and above the production of any aesthetic effective effects by which Nigel Thrift suggests atmospheres are modulated or developed by art forms such as dance. My concerns here are very much with this latter situation, though, and perhaps as a result, the more political concerns I mentioned appear only distractedly at the background of attention, rather like the cold city air outside the window of a warm Beijing studio. One is temporarily insulated against the other, even if in due course one must venture back outside. Discussing the production of atmospheres, Gernot Boehmer has suggested, directs one's attention close to the sphere of theatrical performance. Although he has drawn further on the theatre in developing the notion of the character of atmospheres, he is not straightforwardly concerned with the production or interpretation of literary dramas with which the theatre is predominantly associated in Anglophone contexts. Indeed, one might argue that his concerns are more in keeping with the sort of post-dramatic theatre identified by his compatriot Hans Thies Lehmann as encompassing a range of experimental practices which have inveigled their way into the theatrical mainstream since the 1960s. In eschewing the staging of dramatic texts in favour of the presentation of what he calls the peculiar temporality and spatiality of the scenic process, Lehmann's post-dramatic theatre becomes, quote, more the staging of an atmosphere and state of things, end quote. Although he discusses a variety of cool, claustrophobic and relaxed atmospheres and so on, given the centrality of this idea to what he suggests post-dramatic theatre ultimately stages, he is rather coy in avoiding any clear expression of what he means by atmosphere or the atmospheric. Boehmer, by contrast, is more straightforward, suggesting that atmospheres are, quote, the in-between between human sensibilities and environmental qualities, for which theatre is symptomatic. Theatre, in other words, is the deliberate staging of these sorts of in-between states. Theatrical atmospheres are moods which both belong to those experiencing them, but can also objectively be said to have been brought about through the synesthetic and communicative intervention of its various devices, such as music, lighting, set, gesture, and so on. As post-dramatic theatre moves away from what Lehmann calls a mental, intelligible structure, it also shifts towards the exposition of intense physicality, synonymous with dance. Whilst both of these propositions may be up for question in terms of their relative artistic merits, there's little doubt, I would argue, that theatre and dance no longer sit neatly on either side of a putative mind-body split along the lines of language and gesture. So back to Beijing. Ma Xiaolong is a member of the Beijing Dance Academy Company, a position perhaps equivalent to membership of the Royal Ballet in Britain, but remembering that such elites in China are drawn from a population of more than a billion. He is a quite astonishing performer, light but strong, and able to wring a seemingly endless number of expressive possibilities from the simplest of movements. As such, he's absolutely in his element here. He knows much of what he has to do in line with the instinct of his innate talent and the tacit knowledge of his training that he shares with his colleagues. Fang Ji is 8 years old. This is his first experience of dance, and as a deaf child in this specialist world of elite adults, does not have direct access to their spoken language or to the repertoire of ready-to-hand techniques and concepts that come with it. He moves with a delicate, guileless beauty. The choreographer Liu Yan is not present this afternoon, but her rehearsal director, Chen Maoyuan, this is her, leads the proceeding showing, signing, and smiling. Although I can't understand what's being said in the room, I'm not a Mandarin speaker, I can understand what's at stake. The choreography is set, the opening night is in a week's time, and Maoyuan is trying to draw the performer's attention to not only the form, but also the necessary state of embodiment of their performance. Although both the choreographer, her assistant, and performers are all Chinese, one of them is both deaf and a child. The world inhabited by children is different from that of adults, and adults speak differently to them. Similarly, the language of a deaf Chinese boy is different from that of his compatriots. Furthermore, the boy in question is not a trained dancer and does not have the same repertoire of ready-to-hand techniques and concepts that come with training. The language of dance, so to speak, has to be spoken differently or translated for him. That being said, though, in operating through and shifting his body's sense of its own weight-bearing, vestibular, kinesthetic, and tactile presence, which is what the dance critic Carrie Noland has called a proto-subjectivity, some comprehension in common between him and these others can surely be found. Although it's not an obviously intercultural matter in the way that communications between, say, an English choreographer and a Chinese dancer might be, in watching this rehearsal, I was increasingly made aware of the significance of listening in these sorts of translations. This listening is less an attention to the semantic detail of words than to the qualitative atmospheres they generate or engage. Maoyuan shows Fang Ji the moves he needs to make and gives instructions about direction and timing, but she tries also to show him something of the sorts of feelings she and Liu Yan want him to try and embody and express. At the same time, she does speak to him. The effort to communicate through speech seemingly as important as the information itself. At one point, where Mao Yuan's direction seems particularly intense, I turn to my translator and ask her to explain what she's asking of the performers. She wants more feeling, she suggests. As much as "once more with feeling" might be the defining theatrical cliche of the English language, I am left unsatisfied with this initial gloss, and not only because it's a reduction of what was clearly a longer and more complex direction. That Mao Yuan wanted more feeling certainly helps me to understand the situation in accordance with a certain sort of common sense implicit in English. But what is the hinterland of sensibility behind such ideas as they relate to practice in Mandarin? As much as this translation of this direction was striking in this rehearsal in Beijing, previously, the year before in Taipei, I also noted how often feeling was used in the translation of directions given to performers. Not only because of how consistently it's arisen is it striking, though, but also because it's such an ambiguous term in English in the first place. In relating this moment in the present tense, I don't want to do Yiyan, my translator, down. She had a difficult, complex job to do, and much of what I'm about to go on to discuss is the fruit of a further discussion with her following this initial effort. Was it the generation of feeling or sentiment for the spectator that she wanted, or some more passionate involvement on the part of the dancers? My asking this question led Ian to run through a series of nuances of her initial translation, which eventually led to a much longer set of discussions with Chinese and Taiwanese colleagues on the project. My exposition here is not a word-for-word recounting of that discussion, but in trying to elaborate what the direction had been, Ian variously suggested that Mao Yuan had been asking the dancers to A, try and have a feeling of listening. B, to try and share the same feeling. C, to try and share the same feeling and thoughts. And D, to try and imbue their dancing together with similar feeling. This complex, she eventually suggested, is encapsulated in the Mandarin term gongming. Forgive my pronunciation, any Mandarin speakers. Although often translated into English as resonance, like the feeling it also implies, it's a multi-level term. It can be deployed in relation to physics as a descriptor of synchronous vibrations, a state of common understanding in interpersonal communications or conversation, or, in more effective terms, of consonant or empathetic feelings between or amongst individuals. As is often the case with Mandarin, there's also a more poetic layer of meaning within the language that makes itself apparent when its translation is taken at face value. Gong refers to togetherness and sharing, whilst Ming refers to sound, and in particular, the sound or song of birds. Taken literally then, a Taiwanese colleague suggested to me, Gong Ming is the sound of birds singing together. Whilst it's cognate in some degree with empathy in English, Gong Ming thus describes a form of affect which is not wholly reducible to the experience of individuals. Indeed, if we continue to take the sound of birds singing at face value, it's an affect which is out there, vibrating in the air between and amongst them, individuals. Whether one finds the poetics of this idea charming or not, as my Chinese and Taiwanese colleagues were keen to demonstrate, it has a material reality in the acoustic qualities of the. There is a material reality in the acoustic qualities of the expression "gong ming" as it resonates in the nasal cavity of the speaker. So you have to say "ming" in your nose so that you get this front of the face resonance. This reminds us that words are not only representations formed around acoustic vibrations, but are also the felt consequences of speech itself sounding and resounding in and amongst the bodies of the speakers and their listeners. In this respect, Mao Yun's direction towards the production of Gong Ming is a request for a mode of embodiment which might be defined less as a matter of subjectivity than as one that opens out to and includes the presence of others, underlined by the notion of birds singing together. It's not the singing of any one single bird that is at stake, so much as the overall aesthetic effect. To return this to dance, then, which is often thought of as a silent form of expression. The readiest image with which theatrical dance is associated is, of course, the swan, which, like the dancer, is famously silent despite its graceful appearance. Ironically, perhaps, the etymology of the word swan itself can be traced back through Old German and Dutch to an initial literal meaning as the singing bird, following the Indo-European root swan or swen, meaning to sing or make sound. Whilst the swan may itself be largely silent, although it's mythically believed to sing in its death throes from where we get the swan song, we can still conceive of appreciating or paying attention to its aesthetic form in terms of a reverberation, in which its form and movement resound within us, in English at least. For Gernot Berman, this sort of appreciation is atmospheric, since it's not only the movement and form of the swan itself which resounds, but also the smooth, supple, and graceful character which it emanates. Although these atmospheric qualities are experiences in terms of one's own emotional state, Berman suggests, we nevertheless determine them as consequences of something out there, something which can come over us, into which we are drawn, and which takes possession of us like an alien power. They are, he argues, excessive of the subjective-objective divide, along which theories about aesthetics conventionally place themselves. Dance is not only analogous for the shaping of atmospheres through the acoustic qualities of language, I suggest, but offers a particularly appositive example of how attending to atmospheres offers a means of understanding collective affects which are not reducible to the bodies they emanate from. However, although dance has often been described as an art form in which the body speaks, in terms of those forms which fall under the general bracket of modern dance, of which this was an example, it's also possible to consider what they speak of or to as being self-contained rather than referential. Rather than referring to some psychological state or idea, what is expressed is not some external object, but an attention to the movement of expression itself. As Carrie Nolan has written of Merce Cunningham, there is, quote, no external reference that the body's movement refers to. It's not expressing more than it is, or rather, more than it is doing, end quote. This is, she argues, an embodied response to the utterly unique conditions of existence at any one given point in time. By shifting the emphasis of what dance expresses from representation to embodiment, Nolan argues, it can be thought of as intransitive, in the sense of not taking up or relating to a direct object. Being intransitive, it does not easily pass over from one thing to another, as one language term might stand in for that of another. Instead, it is there in between them. What's instructive about Mao Yuang's desire for her performers to attend to Kunming in their dancing is that it requires them to attend to a feeling which is both within and without them. Furthermore, because it required both the adult and the child dancer to try and develop a shared sort of feeling between and within their individual embodied actions, the atmosphere it develops is not simply in or pervading the space it takes up, but is part of a series of active currents within it, just as the calls of songbirds lay out and continually define the boundaries of territories between them. Okay. Thank you.